You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast that covers all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All comments are current at the time of publication. It's a podcast that's brought to you by the barristers at One Crown Office Row. And this edition is presented by Rosalind English.
This month, the Civil Justice Council Working Group reported on their review of a number of aspects of the civil costs regime in this country. Their recommendations related to, amongst others, guideline hourly rates, costs budgeting, and pre-action and digitisation. Whilst this may not set your hearts racing, dear listeners, my guest today will convince you that the cost of law is bound to, has to go down, not just because of reports like these, but because of the capabilities of technology. 10 years ago, Richard Susskind, technology advisor to the Lord Chief Justice of England and Wales, predicted that as technology became increasingly capable, some current legal jobs would fade, new jobs would emerge, although many of those would be taken over by machines. Since the pandemic forced lawyers and judges alike to transact their business online, Richard has brought out the latest edition of his book, Tomorrow's Lawyers: An Introduction to Your Future. Richard, we first met over the interviewing table in the early 90s at the BBC World Service, when the internet was, of course, in its infancy. How things have changed. Thank you so much for bringing your expertise to LawPod UK.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Rosalind.
I'd like to start with a quote from the publicity material for your book. It says, "For Richard Susskind, the future of the legal service is neither Grisham nor Rumpole. Instead, he predicts a world of online courts, AI-based global legal businesses, liberalised markets, commoditisation and alternative sourcing, disruptive startups, legal training in virtual reality, and a new range of law jobs." So let's start with tech, then we'll move on to costs, because it's clear that in your view, they are intertwined. First, can you tell me about an acronym that we keep seeing in the news? GPT.
Well, in a sense, that's the wrong question, because the enabling technologies are far less important for me than their impact. I've for long drawn a distinction between what I call the architectural and the functional side of all of this, because the architecture, which preoccupies many people, is all the technical terms of it, generative transformation and all the rest of it. But what's really important is that our machines are becoming increasingly capable, that our systems are doing more and more, and we're reading daily and hearing daily news of systems that are taking on tasks that historically we thought would only be undertaken by human beings. And this is the great breakthrough. In my view, and this is my, 42nd year of working in artificial intelligence and law, ChatGPT is, in fact, for me, the most remarkable advance I've seen in the period I've been working. However, I still think we're in the foothills. This is just an indication of how powerful these systems may yet become. And for me, in the context of law, how much help they will be able to give people who are otherwise, it seems to me, excluded from the legal process. So I don't want to get bogged down on generative AI and chat and whether it be 3.5 or 4, because I think these are misleading signals. What we have to think about is a world in which our machines are doing more and more, and how we can harness that power for the benefit of citizens and the users of legal services and court services too.
So let's talk about the attitudes of the legal profession to all of this. You mentioned in your book that most lawyers had not heard of Watson, AlphaGo, GPT-3 and effective computing. Should we be surprised at that?
I don't think so. I don't celebrate it, but lawyers traditionally have been conservative in relation to technology. I think we saw during COVID, and this really was remarkable, we saw during COVID a fundamental shift in the way in which lawyers and judges worked, and a very rapid shift too. So that suggested to me that it's not that lawyers are incapable of adapting to technology, it's just historically they've enjoyed and the way they've always worked. So it never surprises me that lawyers aren't on top of the latest technologies.
However, ChatGPT has been a real eye-opener because it's immediately demonstrable in a way that many other technologies haven't been, that you have a technology there, you just simply sign up, log on, and away you go. Whereas hearing news about a system that plays the board game Go or can analyze the molecular structure of proteins more accurately never really resonates. And so we're seeing, I think, greater interest. But by and large, lawyers are busy people. They're preoccupied with their clients and their businesses. And it's not built in to the daily work of lawyers to keep up with the latest technology. This has to change, in my view. But historically, the work of lawyers has been relatively free of technology other than in the back office for accounting, word processing, and so forth. So the big shift we're seeing now is that these technologies might be used in the actual delivery of legal and court services at the cutting edge of legal work.
And you very definitely say that insofar as you've asked these questions of lawyers, solicitors and barristers, their response is, well, of course, machines can replace other people's work, but my work is bespoke. Is that right?
Well, it's very interesting. This. My son Daniel and I wrote a book in 2015, updated it last year, called The Future of the Professions, and we looked at across 8 different professions, and it genuinely is the case that almost all professionals say, well, technology is limited in my area, but I can see ample scope elsewhere. We all do the special pleading, and I understand this. We're all committed to and feel very emotional about the work that gives our lives meaning. But I've never really seen any particular profession as being more or less susceptible to the kinds of emerging technologies that we're here to discuss.
So you bring in the analogy of what does the customer want when asked of somebody working for a power tool company? And the answer is a drill, a very good drill. And no, the answer is it's a hole in the wall. That's what the customer wants. How is this an analogy for the legal profession?
Well, I've been using this little story for ages because I think people in the drill business think they're selling drills, but the customer actually wants a hole. And it just reminds us that we should think about the value we bring rather than the way in which we currently deliver that value. I put it another way in relation to health. I often say people don't want doctors, they want health. Doctors are the best way of delivering solutions to various kinds of health problems today, and thank goodness for them. But we can imagine a future in which many of our health problems are avoided or solved differently. The future, for example, is not, in my view, better or robotic surgery. It's non-invasive therapy and it's preventative medicine. And I think in law, we might have a same mindset that, as I often say, people want a fence at the top of the cliff rather than an ambulance at the bottom. People don't want cheaper or better dispute resolution. They don't want problems at all. They want dispute avoidance. And so I can see a whole move in the future towards a kind of preventative lawyering rather than a problem-solving lawyering. All I'm encouraging by these little stories is just for us to take a step back and ask the question, as I say, what's the fundamental value we bring to those we advise? And in a digital world where there's emerging techniques that help us do things differently and offer wide access to a range of services online, might we satisfy the needs of the market in very different ways? And I say this at a time when we really do have remarkable cost pressures. You mentioned costs at the top of the show. And the reality is even the world's largest organizations, when I undertake research with or indeed speak informally with general counsel, the lawyers who run the legal departments of very large organizations, they often say to me they're under pressure to reduce their spend on external law firms. They're under pressure to reduce their own internal headcount, and yet they have more legal and compliance work to do than ever before. And I call that the more for less pressure, but it applies equally to citizens and consumers. The reality is, for most people, even relatively well-off people, the pursuit of litigation in the courts is something that's unaffordable. And not only that, for many people, it's unintelligible as well unless they're a lawyer, and it's terribly time-consuming. And it's very combative and it generates all manner of angst as well. And so we are at a time where, in many ways, our justice system is creaking. It's not easy for people to understand and enforce their entitlements. And according to the OECD, on a global basis, only 46% of people really have realistic access to lawyers in the courts. Now, I don't think we're going to solve that kind of problem, nor the backlogs we're seeing in some court systems. 70 million in Brazil, 30 million in India. We're not going to solve this, I don't think, by throwing more lawyers and judges at the problem. We need to think in a digital society of different ways of resolving disputes, different ways of satisfying people's needs to have their disputes resolved. And I want to open people's minds to the idea that there are existing and emerging technologies which might play a central role in helping people resolve disputes in a way that is less competitive, that is less costly, that's less time-consuming, that's more intelligible. And that's the focus, actually, of another work I've done, a book on online courts and the future of justice, which is summarized in the Tomorrow's Lawyers book that you mentioned. But I've really tried in a few hundred pages to give this a good going over and explore it and poke and prod and challenge it in all ways. And I come out, and of course I would say this, but I come out very strongly with the view that we can actually deliver a just, proportionate system in different ways. One of the difficulties, of course, is that most people who are directly or indirectly involved with law reform or the reform of the court systems are people who have spent their entire career thinking about legal problem solving in a particular way. And they regard the challenge of technology as one of what I call automation, which is to say computerizing, systematizing, even turbocharging how we've always worked. Whereas I think the great joy of technology or the great appeal is how we can reconceptualize problems and perhaps solve them in entirely different ways. That for me is the big challenge. A quite interesting domestic example of this recently, the Oxford Internet Institute, which I'm attached, was doing some research on the impact of robots on the home. And one of the questions they asked was of a number of us who are involved with AI, in the broadest of terms, how long did we think it would be before a robot could do the ironing? And I said, in a kind of rather unhelpful way, that's the wrong question, because in asking that question, we're focusing on how we go about something today rather than what I call the outcome. And the outcome, of course, is flat fabric. So the question shouldn't be, can computers or robots do the ironing? It's how will we, and this is through material science, how will we solve the problem of flattening fabric? And I say that's a kind of reconceptualization of the problem. If we keep on thinking, as economists encourage us to do, in terms of task substitution, how can we substitute one task for another, machine for a human being and so forth, we just come out with automation, systematizing what we've already done. The challenge with the court system and with the legal system more generally, I think, is to reconceptualize. So this is why I find it really interesting, as in medicine, to think about preventative medicine, I think in lawyering, some of us call legal risk management.
And actually, that brings me to my next question very nicely, which you talk about embedded legal knowledge. So machines such as cars containing the rules and regulations, so humans don't have to. Can you expand on that a bit?
I find this deeply attractive and sometimes slightly scary too. But let me pick a more homely example of the iPhone or the handheld machine that we all have, and many of us play the card game on this, which, Rosalind, when you and I were younger, we played with atoms and we called it patience because we played it with playing cards. But now we call it solitaire and we do it in our machines. Going back to the atoms and the playing cards, I ask you the question, what would have happened when we were younger and we played it with cards and we tried to put a red 4 under a red 5? It was called cheating, of course, but the point is one could have physically done it. What happens when you try to put a red 4 under a red 5 in the electronic version of the system? The move is rejected because the rules are embedded in the system. Non-compliance isn't an option. You embed the rules and the rules are embedded in the code. And I think we're going to see this in many more areas of life. If you think of major financial institutions or manufacturing companies who are automating their workflow, a next step in automation is to build compliance in. So they're not a question of having a human compliance team considering various categories of activity or transaction and deciding whether or not that falls within or beyond the rules. You will actually have encoded, in many cases, compliance within the system. As in more of our everyday objects, the Internet of Things, we sometimes call it, have chips embedded within them, I think we'll see more and more of this compliance within our physical objects. And this will be a move. You mentioned self-driving cars, but we already see it in little buggies and golf courses. It used to be when you're driving a little buggy, there was a little sign that said, do not drive beyond this sign, because they wanted to preserve the area around the green. You now have a sign which says, if you drive beyond this sign, your buggy will stop. So eventually embedded the rule within the system. And I think this is deeply attractive in some areas, but not all areas. There's another school of thought that suggests that part of being human and part of being subject to a set of rules is to be allowed occasionally, in the grey areas at least, to consciously break the rules and take the consequences for them. So some people say this is excessively restrictive. But I think in many areas of business and everyday life, actually having compliance built in just makes sense. And that is equally true if you think, for example, of online form filling. When you're filling a paper form in, often you make errors that, of course, the paper can't detect. But when you're filling an official form in online, we should build the rules in, which say there's too many characters used here or that image is the wrong size and so forth. You can build the rules within the system. So compliance will no longer be just a manual process, a process of which people are conscious and they have to make a decision, do I comply or not. It'll actually be embedded within our everyday objects or everyday processes.
Of course, we have all torn our hair out when trying to fill in online form, which doesn't allow you to put in things that you think you're being asked to put in.
I think a well-designed online form is a great thing to behold, because there's a whole bundle of things happen. I suppose I'm as good or as bad as form filling as anyone, but when you get the 50-page form, the paper form is just so forbidding and it seems endless. When the system breaks down the questions page by page and offers examples and does indeed say that it's not a legitimate answer and allows you to jump out and jump back in again, I think an everyday hassle for human beings is really overcome. Now, if you layer on some AI into this and also some access to pre-existing data, a lot of our everyday form filling that used to be agonizing, and for people who are less used to this kind of work, often really impossible to undertake. I think this is a very positive use. And I think if you use, for example, the government system for registering your car, tax registration, and so forth, and that links into insurance and links to MOT, and there's just one simple question on screen at the same time, I think that's a technological development that's very positive indeed.
For sure. Absolutely. What about the nitty-gritty, going back to the lawyer's office and litigation, the nitty-gritty of evidence and documents and discovery? You talk about blockchain technology being relevant to this.
So blockchain is a very difficult technology to explain. And again, it goes back to you wanting me to talk about generative pre-trained transformers and all the GPT at the beginning. And I say, well, let's not get into the technical details. So now let's talk about people want to talk about hashes and distributed ledgers and all the rest of it. I say put that to one side. This is a way that we can have single definitive records of information that have inbuilt authentication, they're inbuilt authoritative and so forth. And so, for example, if you take public registers, this is a wonderful way of having a single definitive, electronic, reliable, secure online resource. But it goes way beyond that, because often for many transactions, many activities online, if they are stored within this thing, blockchain or blockchains, they have the same characteristic that for evidential purposes in due course, the information stored within them is incontestable. So it brings a level of reliability and solidity to a world where information often seems ephemeral or rather unreliable. And you can see that people want, for example, to take this further with contracts, which they call smart contracts, where the contract itself is stored in this way. And you have this idea of self-executing contracts. So when certain conditions are satisfied, the system automatically takes the next step, which might be the transfer of money. That is recorded on the blockchain, which means it's authoritatively authenticated and people can verify it and so forth. So it brings a level of security and certainty to a lot of our online activities. The blockchain specialists listening to this will think this is a glorious oversimplification, but I want to go back to functional and architectural. Why does it matter to most listeners that we have this bit of kit, this infrastructure? And it's about greater reliability and security and authenticity in a world where we do worry about online truth and reliability of information.
So because this podcast represents a barrister's chambers, without wanting to sound divisive, do you think all these tech changes are going to affect what you call the legal gladiators, the barristers of the world, as much as solicitors?
It's a contentious question that, of course, within the legal profession. I think that many barristers will want to argue, they want to make the gladiatorial point. They'll say, on a bet-the-ranch dispute, surely you'll want the finest advocates to stand up and argue in court in your favour, and you can't imagine a robot standing up instead. And of course, I think for certain categories of dispute for the foreseeable future, the best way that one can pursue, particularly if the law is on your side, pursue an action is through the court system with a great lawyer acting in your behalf. But we are seeing the emergence of what I call online courts, which is a kind of a form of dispute resolution where actually there will be no oral evidence, there will be no physical hearings, and therefore it's a very different kind of skill will be involved. And for me, the access to justice problem, at least in civil, lower value civil cases, the way we'll crack that will be not through more judges and more lawyers and barristers working in the traditional way, but through self-representation, litigants in person, duly empowered by ever more sophisticated systems. So I think at the lower end of the bar for people who do knockabout work, I think we can expect, often when they do so at disproportionate cost in terms of the value of the claim, nature of the claim for the litigants, I think we'll see that much of that will, both in the formal court system and in private sector online dispute resolution, will be displaced and there'll be new ways of resolving disputes. I'm not in the foreseeable future saying that the best silks, their work will be taken on by machines. I also think insofar, again, with senior silks who are offering opinions and so forth, again, the technology is not there to offer a realistic substitute for that. But if you contrast a lot of the work, and we have to be honest about this, in the law office, which is administrative, it's process-based, might involve fairly basic document research, document production, and so forth, the technology is already emerging to take this work on. And so on the face of it, I think is the case. And I say this with no side, because I'm neither a practicing barrister nor a practicing solicitor. I say this with no rancor, with no edge, that I think law firms are in the main more susceptible to or threatened by technological change than the upper end of the bar. I do think, though, that a lot of the work of junior barristers, I say, will be resolved by other methods. That's as balanced as a view as I can offer. Now, I know that many barristers listening in will say, nothing that I could do can ever be taken on by a machine, though I'm pretty safe. And I say that's you trying to compete with the machines. You're saying that your career plan is to do stuff that machines can't. And in a world of increasingly capable machines, I think that's a faulty plan. It also views technology in this way that I was suggesting as simply a kind of task substitution function. Whereas for me, the whole idea of online courts and so forth, it's not computerizing an existing process, it's creating a new process. I often say to people that the competition that kills you doesn't look like you. And it's the same with the technology. The technology that replaces you won't look like you and it won't function like you, but it will solve the problems that the people you help today, it will solve their problems in entirely new ways. So it requires a different mindset. I completely get it because I've spent my whole life speaking to lawyers and other professionals. I completely get it that people think that what they do is not threatened by and large by technology. It's pretty hard, though, with ChatGPT to look at that system and say, this is just a first version. What will it be like in 10 years' time to say that nothing I do might be done differently? So we're at an inflection point. And you may say, well, this is terribly threatening, and for some it is. People often ask, am I optimistic or pessimistic? And I think that very much depends whether or not you're talking about the producer or the recipient of the service. As regards the recipients of service, I can see a glimmer here of how we might crack the access to justice problem. So I'm quite optimistic. If you're a producer and you're unwilling to change the way you work, if you're a lawyer and saying, I'm going to continue working as always I have done, I would be pessimistic for you. But I also think there are great opportunities here. In fact, I go beyond that. I think there are great obligations here. I think across the professions, the challenge and the obligation is to build the systems that replace our old ways of working. I don't think the obligation is to streamline and improve our current court system. I think the challenge is to say what systems might we have in place that could replace
our current ways of working that are often antiquated, unaffordable, and inaccessible.
Okay, so here's a shocker. What about replacing judges with artificial intelligence? I mean, it could be argued that adjudication will be fairer because there are no innate inbuilt human biases. What do you think about the future of the judicial profession?
I don't know if I said at the outset, I think I didn't, but I wrote my PhD on AI and law in the 80s. And one of the questions I asked then, because my interest was legal philosophy, jurisprudence, was could computers ever replace judges? And in fact, I've actually changed my mind on the answer. In the 80s, I very much thought not. And that was very much a purist philosophical point of view. But now I come at it from another direction. And I look at places like Brazil, where they've got a backlog of 70 million cases. And I think with all the will in the world, these are never going to be sorted out by lawyers and judges in the conventional way. And so what I've been advocating, and I write about this in my book on online courts, and it's true to say in Brazil and Italy and Singapore, to pick three jurisdictions as examples, they're taking this really seriously, is the idea that you might actually have conclusions or determinations by machines that could be backed by the coercive powers of the state. I think if you're asking the question, can you ever have a machine in the foreseeable future that will think and reason and empathize and express mercy and concern for fellow human beings in the way that a human judge can? And the answer to that is no. A lesser proposition, can you imagine a system that might generate conclusions with explanations? I can foresee that far more easily. It's not mimicking or, again, copying the way a lawyer or a judge would reason, but it would be offering some kind of conclusion and determination. So the generative AI we're seeing just now, a system that generate content, already you can ask it a legal problem and it will offer you an answer. Of course, people will say it's often wrong, and I accept that. But looking a number of years ahead, it's now, I think, entirely foreseeable that you could submit to such a system two points of view. It could poke and prod and ask some questions, and it would come out with some kind of conclusion, with some kind of explanation, although all of that's rather contentious. There's another model where you have these predictive systems. There are systems now that can predict the outcome of court systems more accurately than using the legal method, which is quite remarkable. And one of the things I suggest is you could imagine, say, in Brazil, where you've explained to the parties that their case will never be settled by the court system because of the delay, but you could say we have a system that, based on all the past decisions of our court, is able to offer a prediction of how our court would decide this case if it came before you. And you could say to the parties, would you accept that conclusion of the system as a binding determination with the backing of the state, every bit as binding as a human decision? Now, my point in both these cases, whether or not it be generative AI or predictive AI, is these are not human decisions. But that doesn't mean they are useless. They might be determinations or conclusions by a system in which there's trust, and they may be subjected to all sorts of tests. And I can imagine a world, particularly a world of people who are currently teenagers, where they would think actually having a decision today generated by a machine on the basis of past human decisions might be better than waiting 3 to 5 years and instructing external lawyers and so forth. So I think the question, computer replace judges, it's not an unhelpful question, but it leads us down to these task substitutional questions and comparing the way humans work with machines work. Yeah, go back to the outcomes. Can we imagine the state developing a set of systems that will provide determinations or conclusions that will be dispositive and that will be binding in a way that are more convenient but different from judges? Yes, that's entirely conceivable. Can we imagine an AI system that is in all respects intellectually superior to the human being? I can imagine that. I know others can't. But that's not within, I think, the foreseeable timescales of policymakers who look 5 or 10 years ahead. But within the next couple of years, we could have systems that are helping sort out legal problems. Now, many people say, well, it's not a judicial decision. What about the common law? And I address all of these issues, but part of me just wants to be practical. Lots of people have problems they'd like solved. Most people can't afford it today. Most people can't understand it today. We as lawyers and judges regard the perfect way of resolving these systems as lawyers and judges engaging in the way they always have done, but often everyday problems require a more proportionate response. And I think technology might provide us with this. So I'm happy to debate the issue. What I'm less comfortable with people who reject it out of hand. And this takes us a little bit into the AI regulation area, because there's quite a lot of people in the AI area of ethics and regulation who will say a system should never deliver a judicial decision. And I think that rather closes down the discussion, which I want to open up in the way I've just suggested. And I think even framing it as a judicial decision is tendentious. We need to take a step back and ask, just as we say, or I say, people don't want doctors, they want health. Ask the question, I don't think people want judges, they want, and what is it? They want a problem avoided, they want a problem de-escalated, they want a problem resolved very quickly. The current mechanisms we have that you and I are deeply familiar with as lawyers have stood us in good stead for quite a while, but I think we should open our minds to other ways of working in a digital society.
That's a very thorough summing up of what you regard as, and I'm completely with you, as something that's going to happen not in the very far future. What would you say to a young person aspiring to go into the law today?
I think if you are going into the law because of Grisham and Rumpel, going back to the quotation from the blurb of my book, then you'll be disappointed. It's a bit like whether or not you're going into medicine. I say to people, don't go into medicine if you want to be a surgeon or a physician in the way your parents or your neighbors or your aunt and uncle are, but do go into medicine if you're interested in improving people's health. But you'll be doing that in very different ways. A lot of it will be building systems to help improve health and help prevent medical problems. I say the same in law. I wouldn't encourage people to go into law if they would imagine they will be working, say, in 15, 20 years' time in the way the big city firms work, or indeed in the way our major courts work today. I think it'll be a very different world. But what people will have in common, I hope, is that they want to help people with legal difficulties. They just find different ways of doing that. They're interested in pursuing justice. We'll just find different ways of doing that. So if your passion is justice and helping people with legal difficulties, please still go into the law, but don't be expecting to do this in the way you always did in the past. And so I could imagine, for example, a social welfare lawyer who might in his or her lifetime maybe help tens of thousands of people who have difficulties. I could imagine that same kind of lawyer developing systems that could help millions of people. And so our impact could be far greater, but we'll no longer be one-to-one, face-to-face consultative advisors. Will be, as I said earlier, building the systems that replace our old ways of working.
You wrote a book over a quarter of a century ago, The Future of Law. When that book was published, only 35 million people were online. Now there are 5 billion internet users. So my guess is that quite possibly next time we meet to do a podcast, or whatever the 2030 version of a podcast is, we may well have chips in our brains. Can you please share your views about transhumanism?
Well, first of all, say in 1996 when I wrote that book, I kid you not, and they've changed their tune since then, but senior officials at the Law Society of England and Wales said I shouldn't be allowed to speak in public and that I was bringing the profession into disrepute by suggesting that email would be the dominant way the lawyers and clients would communicate in the future. I think further in that book, I can't remember the precise predictions, but it was unimaginable that there would be billions of people using the internet. I think Nicholas Negroponte, in his book called Being Digital around that time, was anticipating a billion users of the internet by 2000. And he was much castigated for that. And he was a few years out. But for me, and I'm in the business of prediction as well, it's less about timing, it's more about trajectory. So I think the trajectory was right. You raise one of the most fascinating issues, because I think on the one hand, we're going to have to get used to sharing the planet with machines and systems that are wildly more capable than us, not just physically. And we've been used to that for some time. There are road diggers much better than a human digger. But in terms of what we regard as intellectual tasks, we'll have systems that can outperform us significantly. We're not many years away from that just now, and I defy anyone to look at the latest version of ChatGPT and not at least to sense that these systems are already outperforming us in many areas. Not outperforming us in all areas, but it seems to me that that's all but inevitable. So on one view of the future is we are coexisting with a remarkable
complementary or possibly threatening technology. But the other view, of course, is that that people have got evolutionary views, and this is the next stage of evolution, when developments in genetics, nanotechnology and so forth, and bioengineering will mean the dawn of this era of transhumans, where we are no longer just biological entities, we're digital as well. I don't have strong views on this. It seems to me entirely foreseeable. I don't know how it's going to unpack. But I do think that it's naive of us to think we will remain the dominant force on Earth when in 70 years we've created the systems that are already performing at a remarkably high level. It may well be that we either join forces, as it were, and enter an era of transhumanism where we combine what's wonderful about humanity with the astonishing capability of our machines, or we live in parallel with, and I don't have strong views either way. But to some extent, we're already there. When you look at the resources that you and I have at our disposal on our phones, if you take just ChatGPT and Wikipedia and Google together, we can call that external storage to us. It's not within our bodies, but it's beyond our bodies. We are at the very early stages of being enormously dependent on and daily users of these systems. Where physically they reside may not really be the point. But of course, also physically we're seeing, whether it be prosthetics or robotic prosthetics and so forth, we're seeing, particularly for people who's, for example, suffered dreadful injuries, we're seeing that we can actually add to our bodies mechanical, robotic elements with which we can already interact. And that's phenomenal. So very, very profound implications for what it is to be a human being and what it is we're on the planet for.
Yes, and of course the legal profession is no exception to these evolutionary changes that you've just outlined.
I think there's clearly another role for lawyers in this context about how it is we regulate and control these emerging technologies.
Thank you so much, Richard, for coming on LawPod UK for a deep look at this slightly scary future. And as it applies to us lawyers. Maybe next time we speak to each other, we won't be human at all.
No, I'm going to send her on my robot next time, if that's okay.
Yeah, that's fine. That's
fine.
Thanks, Richard.
Many thanks to you.
LawPod UK is presented by Rosalind English and produced by One Crown Office Row.